Take your Bibles and turn to 2 Kings this evening, if you would. 2 Kings, 'tis the season. We remember the birth of Jesus as a baby in Bethlehem. We just sang about it. We did that this morning. Chapter 4, while you're in 2 Kings there. I should not turn in my Bible and read and look and talk at all the same time. Am I chewing gum too? Because something is messing me up. In the 8th century, however, B.C., there was another birth of a baby boy. This, of course, was far less significant than the birth of the Messiah. We're not even given this young lad's name. We don't know his mother's name or his father's name. And the last time we looked at our prophet Elijah, he supplied the needs of a widow who had two sons by providing oil, which they could sell. It's just 7 verses in the beginning chapter 4. This time, in not the remainder of the chapter, but the center section of the chapter, the longest of the 3 sections of it, we have a married couple with no children. Different situation, different challenges. Same prophet, same God. Before we begin, we need to make a couple of comparisons between the 2 accounts. Remember, all these things that are in the Bible are where they are, in the way they are, because God directed the writing of the Scriptures. So you find a chapter like this, and you find it bracketed with 2 short accounts and this big one in the middle. What do you think that means? The big one in the middle is saying something. It's focusing there to the big account in the middle. So we'll compare these first 2 accounts. The first woman is poor, worse than poor. She's broke. She's in debt. The second woman, we will see in a few minutes, is, by comparison, wealthy. And quite honestly, by any standard in that century, she is quite wealthy. She's not broke. She's not a widow. She has funds to spare. But what was of primary importance to particularly Jewish women? She was barren. Yep. Having children. Widow in the first 7 verses had 2 sons. This lady has none. Another thought. The first event occurred, all the aspects of the event occurred in seemingly short order. Think for a second. We're broken, we're in trouble. Tell me what you have. Go gather as many pots as you can. I'll wait. Start pouring. Don't stop until all the pots are full. Now, sell the oil, pay the debts, go and live, end of story, right? This one is considerably longer. Think about it. It seems to last for a number of years. Look at some verses with me. Look at verse 1. Did I say verse 1? Look at verse 8. It fell on a day. Verse 11, it fell on a day. Verse 18, when the child was grown, it fell on a day. Verse 16 and 17, about the season of life, you see that? 17, she conceived at that season. Do you see the difference? Look at all the time that seems to be in there. And I didn't even get into the portion where the lad dies, because he's old enough to be out in the field, and he dies. So there's a period of years here. Time has been marching on and on and on. There are visits and return visits by Elisha, and we know the account, so we can make those comments without jumping ahead. Okay, so look at verse 8. It fell on a day that Elisha passed to Shunem, where was a great woman, and she constrained him to eat bread. And so it was that as often as he passed by, he turned in there to eat bread. This becomes our context. It fell on a day that Elisha was walking toward his destination, and he's passing through this little village called Shunem. Now, this is fascinating. How many of you know what the name Shunem means? Don't look at your study Bible. It means double resting place. Isn't that interesting? Didn't Elisha ask for a double blessing of Elijah's power? And here he's resting at the double resting place. Now, I don't know what to think of that. I just think it's fascinating. Sometimes there are things in the Word of God that fascinate you like that. That's one of them. It was a place at the eastern end of the Jezreel Valley, located about 5 miles south of Mount Tabor. Mount Tabor is the site of the battle between the Israelites, their army, under the leadership of Barak, and a certain Canaanite king named Hazor, and Jabin, commanded by a guy named Sisera. You remember him from the book of Judges? Chapter 4 and 5. In that little village lived this great woman who obviously noticed Elisha making these trips through her village there, past probably down Main Street, right past her house. Verse 9 says that he passed by continually. The woman is described as a great woman. I have to be really careful here. It's a common Hebrew word. It's used over 500 times. It's the same word that's in the book of Jonah, describing the fish, the city, the board, great, gadol, over 500 times. It can mean greatness in all kinds of ways. It can mean greatness in respect to size. Great woman. Number, as in a great number. Intensity, greatness. Loud, great voice kind of thing. The little kids in here, right? Scare them. It can refer to age. Be careful here, to age. Nat and Tom are of great age. I am not. And none of the women here are. It can mean great as in important. You wouldn't call the king, for instance, half pint. He's great. He's the king. Distinguished can be great in respect to being distinguished, being great among people. In this context, though, we can discern that great is in reference, at least somewhat, to her wealth. Because she has the resources, the means to get things done, means to provide for others. But great could also be, in this context, in respect to wisdom. Look at verse 9. She said to her husband, "Behold now, I perceive that this is a holy man of God which passes by us continually." She could have been very wise. Great could also be in reference to her generosity. Verse 10, "Let us make a little chamber, I pray thee, on the wall, and let us set for him there a bed, and a table, and a stool, and a candlestick. And it shall be, when he comes to us, that he will turn in thither. She wants to build an addition on the house. She wants to, there's no other way to look at this. She wants to make a room. A chamber. She wants to put an addition on her house so she can accommodate this man of God and his servant as her house guests. She wants to furnish it. And she also will then, of course, want to feed her house guests. How many of y'all would have a guest in your house and not offer to feed him? That's half the fun. She wants to furnish it. You know, someday our dream is to have an addition on the back of our house. If you've been to our home, and a good number of you have, we'd love to have you all there, but we need an addition on the back of the house to accommodate all those guests.
We'd love to have you all at Christmas. Wouldn't that be fun? How can we get that edition? But that's why we want an addition. Yeah, we want to be able to sit there and look out in the back and look through those windows and see the deer and the antelope play and all that. We really do have the deer. We don't have the antelope. But we'd like to put an addition on, and the reason is to be better able to accommodate our guest. It fell on a day, verse 11, that he came thither and he turned into the chamber and he lay there, speaking of Elisha now. So the plan worked. Elisha and Gehazi stop at the woman's place. They enjoy rest from their travels. Now, we sometimes have to do the following when we look at the Word of God. I know that you know, and you know that I know that you know the rest of this account. But pretend you don't for a minute. Just pretend you don't. This woman teaches us some things. She's described as a great woman, which we just saw can mean a number of things with respect to greatness. She's observant. Her observations have stirred her heart. She's wise. She discerns. This is a man of God. She's kind and she's gracious. She wants to minister to God's man. She's humble. She asks for no payment, no reward. And we know the account. We know that she didn't ask for a thing. So in her mind, when she says to her husband, let's add a chamber onto the house, let's go build some more, there is no thought in her mind of a reward. So she's humble. Can I suggest we follow that example? What a good example. She knows this is a man of God. She said it. Which she knows then means she's serving God by serving God's man. She is taking good care of God's man. That is serving God. Look at verse 12. He, that would be Elisha, said to Gehazi, his servant, call this Shunammite. And when he had called her, when Gehazi had called her, she stood before him. And he said unto him, he, Elijah, said to Gehazi, got to keep your pronouns straight here, say now unto her. So Elisha says, Gehazi, this is what you say. Behold, you have been careful for all of us, for us with all this care. See that? What is to be done for thee? Would thou be spoken for to the king or to the captain of the host? And she answered, and I love this phrase, I dwell among mine own people. That is a fascinating conversation. First, Elisha has Gehazi do the talking. Elisha recognizes what the woman has done. Thou hast been careful for us with all this care. Apparently, she was doing a wonderful job. I want to stay at her house. She's doing a great job. Spared no expense. And we already said she wanted no reward. So Elisha, who I believe, J.D., are you back there? Didn't Elisha serve four kings, or was it five? See, I put him on the spot.
I want to say five, but
maybe
it is four.
Might be five. We'll agree that it was four or five kings. Okay? He knows his way around. Elijah was very uncomfortable in the presence of kings, but Elisha may have even been related to one. He's rubbing elbows with the kings. So for him to make a statement like this, this is not presumptuous on his part. He can do this. A fascinating conversation. She wants no reward. This is high-level intervention, if she wants it. Note this phrase, I dwell among my own people. It's a Hebrew idiom. It means I'm content with my place in life. I'm happy here. I'm doing what I want to do. I'm serving you. Put an addition on the house. I'm glad you're comfortable. And she apparently walks away. Contentment. That's what that means. She's one content lady. We all enjoy that feeling of contentment, don't we? I move that we move the Sunday evening service back to 4 o'clock
so that we can be done at 5 o'clock and I could go home and put a fire in my fireplace. Because by the time we get home at 8 o'clock, it's too late to put a fire in my fireplace. We have a fireplace. It's an actual wood-burning fireplace. Yes, we still split wood. We used to split wood. Now we borrow the machine and go, and it splits wood. We love to put a fire in our fireplace on cold evenings, sip coffee, chat, read. Maybe someone will be watching Hallmark. It's a wonderful thing, that feeling of contentment, isn't it? It's a wonderful thing. But the question, can we be content when the world around us is in a constant state of turmoil? Can we? You are a chicken, aren't you? Yeah, of course we can. An unequivocal yes. We have two problems with contentment. Well, at least two that I came up with. One, we don't really understand what real contentment is. So our expectations are wrong, or our expectations are misplaced, maybe, incorrect. Second thing is we think that things or circumstances bring us contentment. It's easy to look at this account and say, well, this woman had every reason to be content. She was wealthy. She had no problems. She had no child, especially a son. Yet, she was content. I am good where I am. I am dwell among my own people. Paul wrote to Timothy this in chapter 6, verse 8. Godliness with contentment is great gain. For we brought nothing into this world, neither did that lady. And it's certain we carry nothing out, neither would that lady, neither did she. Having food and raiment, let us be therewith content. The word content means to be satisfied, to have sufficient, to suffice, to be enough. The idea is that we don't need anything more. We might want, but we don't need anything more. We are not coveting more. We are not coveting something different. Yeah, we want an addition someday on our house, but we're not going to die over it. I'll tell you that right now. God has given us a beautiful home. In Hebrews 13, we read this. Let your, and I'm going to lose the old English word there. Let the way you live your life, the manner of living, be without covetousness and be content. There's a contrast. Covetousness is an absolute indication of lack of content. Let your manner of life be without covetousness. Be content with such things as you have. For he hath said, I will never leave thee nor forsake thee. Is God enough for you? Is he? That's a tough question. If God took our home away, would God be enough for us? Don't say it quickly. If God took your children away, would that be enough for you? Those are tough questions. Be content with such things as you have, for he says, I'll never leave you nor forsake thee. But verse 6, so that we may boldly say, the Lord is my helper, and I will not fear what men shall do. Verse 6 there indicates that we are recognizing that it is the Lord who makes the provision for us. The Lord is my helper. Yeah, you have to go to work. We all have to go to work. We all expect to get a paycheck. We all expect to get dividends or whatever back from our investments. We all expect a return for the work and the effort we put out. But who gave you the ability to do that work? Who gave you that position? Who gave you those funds to invest? Well, I earned them. Yeah, you earned them. Who gave you the job? We're going to go round back to the same thing. You're always going to find the Lord at the end of the sentence. He did it. Then Paul wrote this to the Philippians in chapter 4. Not that I speak in respect of want, for I have learned in whatever state I am therewith to be content. Ooh. I know both how to be abased, poor, downtrodden, broke. I know how to abound, have everything I need and more. Everywhere and in all things I'm instructed both to be full and to be hungry, both to abound and to suffer need. And then the sentence, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me. I want to comment on that verse 13 there. Notice the context in which it is written. Paul isn't saying what so many people are saying when they quote that verse out of context. Paul is not saying, it's a blanket statement, that you can do any old thing and it'll work for you because, well, I'm doing it through this through Christ. That's presumption on a pretty high level. That'd be like me saying, well, I can go order that addition on the house, you know, okay, and it'll just get handled because I did it through Christ. Nonsense. Utter nonsense. A lot of Christians have gotten themselves in a lot of trouble taking that verse out of context. The context in which it is Paul being able to be content in whatever state he finds himself in. Paul says he learned being content with our place, our stature, our financial position, our number of grandchildren, or whatever. It's a learned thing, which tells us that being content is a constant struggle against our old nature, a constant struggle against it. Oh, I have a 10-inch table saw. You know, if I had a 12-inch table saw, I could cut bigger pieces of wood. And if I had that 12-inch table saw, next thing you know, I'd probably want a 14-inch table. Now you're talking thousands of dollars for one saw. I'm perfectly content with 10. I'll flip the board over and cut it again. Really? Not being content is to say God hasn't provided what you need. This lady has been walking with Yahweh, and she doesn't have a son. And we'll read in a minute, I think, that her husband is old, and so her idea of having a son is like zero, negative 10. She's not going to have one. This great woman has learned contentment. Now, again, put yourself here in the spot where you know the story. I know you know it. She's childless, she's barren, her husband is old. Down there at verse 14, it'll tell you that. She said then, her husband is old, at the end of verse 14. She could have made request of Elisha. He was certainly wanting to be generous. She knew he was a man of God. But she was content where she was. Are we content where we are? If not, why not? Apparently, she left Elisha's presence back at the narrative. She's not seeking anything for herself. Two reasons we know that. Number one, Gehazi answers. And number two, in verse 15, Elisha says, call her back. So before I get too far ahead of myself, look at 14. Elisha asked Gehazi. He, Elisha, said, what then is to be done for her? And Gehazi answered, truly, she has no child, and her husband is old. And he, Elisha, said, call her. And when he, Gehazi, had called her, she stood in the door. A thought or two about Gehazi before we go back to our great woman. He appears to be to Elisha what Elijah had been to Elijah. You say that three times fast. He's his mentee. First thing about Gehazi is he appears to be paying some pretty good attention, isn't he? He's right there in the midst of it. Notice that Elisha has Gehazi speaking to the woman. It's like he's teaching him to communicate with this woman. He's paying attention.
He notices the barrenness. She has no child. And he is apparently comfortable enough and close enough with Elisha to make the suggestion. And so Elisha acts on the suggestion. When he had called her, she stood in the door. Verse 16, and he said, about this season, according to the time of life, thou shalt embrace a son. That's the one thing this great woman probably wanted to hear all of her life. And now she gets here to the mature part of her life where she's probably not going to have any children because her husband is old. And if that strikes you as odd, remember, older men married teenage girls. It was pretty much a cultural thing. There could have been 10, 15, maybe 20 years difference between these two. She may still be capable of having a child, and he's not capable of fathering one. This is not an unusual thing here. But she knows her husband's old. It's not going to happen. Here's the point. This is a faithful woman of God. A great woman. If we were to read again verses 8 through 10, Elisha passed to Shunem where there was a great woman. She constrained him. That word has the force of, there's no way you're getting out of here without having lunch, Elisha. Just so forget about it. And so it was that as often as he passed by, she didn't even have to constrain him anymore. He just knew I'd better stop in and say hello to the Shunammite woman because she's got lunch on. And she said unto her husband, I perceive now, this is a holy man of God who passes through us continually. Let us make a little chamber, I pray. Look at this. This is a faithful woman of God. Look at verse 16. And he said, about this season, according to the time of life, you're going to embrace a child, a son. And she said, no, my Lord, thou man of God. She knows who he is. Do not lie to thine handmaiden. Look at verse 21. She went up and laid him. Now, I know we jumped way ahead, but remember, you don't know that you forgot you know the story, right? She went up and laid him on the bed of the man of God. Where did she take her now dead son that God had promised her, the man of God had promised her? She takes him up and lays him on his bed in the room that she built and shut the door upon him, and she went out. And she called her husband and said, send me, I pray thee, one of the young men and one of the donkeys that I may run to the man of God and come again. Wow. Look at verse 24. And she saddled the donkey and said to her servant, drive and don't stop. Go forward. Slack not thy riding. Well, you know what it says. Except I say to slow down. She went, she came to the man of God to Mount Carmel. And it came to pass when the man of God saw her afar off that he said to Gehazi, his servant, behold, yonder is that Shunite woman. Wow. Look at verse 27. And when she came to the man of God to the hill, she caught him by the feet. And Gehazi came near and thrust her away. And the man of God said, leave her alone. Her soul is vexed within her, and the Lord has hid it from me. And he has not told me. This is a woman who goes right to the man of God. Yeah, Gehazi's been doing the stuff, but she wants... It's a funny thing. We don't have it in this church so much. But in large churches... We've talked about this in some of the doctoral classes. In large churches, the pastors are always trying to figure out how to care for the people because they can't care for that many sheep. It's too big. So they have associate pastors. We have four deacons, and the deacons have divided you all up into four groups, and each deacon is responsible to kind of keep tabs on everybody or to help them when they make a phone call or check up on them. But it's been my experience everywhere I've been, and it's been the experience of all these guys I've been in these classes with, that eventually the people want the pastor. Now, you talk to Matt, he'll tell you. You talk to Tom or Ross, they'll tell you. Eventually they want the pastor. Now, why, Nat? We're nothing special. But we are the pastor. She goes right to the prophet of God. Okay, here we go. Another one. Verse 30.
And the mother of the child said, as the Lord liveth, and as thy soul liveth, I will not leave thee. So Elisha arose and followed her. Look at verse 37. Then she went in, fell at his feet, bowed herself to the ground, took up her son, and went out.
It's going to be a Mother's Day passage, don't you think? One scholar wrote, this story, and I don't like that word, of course, illustrates the great blessing, fertility, that God will bring on those who award him the place he deserves. Who else in the Old Testament did that? It starts with an H. Hannah. Same problem. Barren. But she gave to Yahweh the place he deserved, the place that is his.
He went so far as to get in giving this infertile woman a son and then restoring him to life when he died. Her respect for Yahweh is clear from her respect for his prophet. Boy, is that good stuff.